They weren't just watching us, they were shaping us. From the shadows of fake profiles and AI-generated conversations, a foreign nation launched a silent war, one waged not with bombs, but with memes, emotion triggers, and synthetic communities. I was just a data analyst until I stumbled into the belly of a digital beast that controlled what we think, how we vote, even who we hate. And when I tried to expose it, they marked me for deletion. But I'm still here. And now, it's my turn to rewrite the narrative, because the echo always returns. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Echoes of Influence. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The First Seed. You ever wonder when exactly the world went off course? Like really, at what point did the truth become optional? When did opinions start masquerading as facts, and facts become just another weapon in the algorithm's arsenal? I used to think I could pinpoint the moment. A policy change. An election. A leaked document. But it wasn't anything that obvious. It was quieter than that. Slower. Like rot beneath the floorboards. My name is Casey Myers, and I used to believe in facts. I built my entire life around them. Numbers. Graphs. Predictive models. I worked for a boutique behavioral analytics firm tucked inside an unmarked office two blocks off DuPont Circle. Most days, I was just another government subcontractor running data through soulless software, tracking sentiment trends and flagging ideological shifts before they boiled over. Nothing special. Nothing dangerous. Just numbers. Until the numbers started talking back. It was October, an election year. The air in D.C. was thick with tension, and every screen in every coffee shop buzzed with rage. My job was to sift through the digital chaos and decode what people were really saying beneath their hashtags. But lately, the noise felt orchestrated. Artificial. Not in volume. There had always been volume. But in tone. In timing. It was like a low, constant hum just under the surface of public discourse. Predictable. Rhythmic. Manufactured. And then she showed up. Her handle was at LaylaRoe_87. I still remember it like a scar. Profile picture? A soft focus candid of a brunette reading on a fire escape. Vintage filter. Half smile. The kind of image that looked stolen from someone's private moment. Her bio was almost suspiciously normal. Book lover. Policy nerd. Rescue dog mom. Speak softly, carry cold brew. Cute. Relatable. Exactly the kind of account you follow without thinking. And I didn't think. I followed her back the second she replied to one of my retweets, a harmless comment about infrastructure reform. God, finally someone talking about roads instead of culture wars, she wrote. Simple. Funny. Grounded. I remember smiling. A stranger online made me smile. And just like that, the first hook went in. What I didn't know, what I couldn't have known, is that Layla wasn't real. Not in the way we understand people to be. She was the beginning of something far more dangerous than I could comprehend at the time. A character in a narrative I hadn't been invited to write, but had been cast in all the same. It started slowly. A like here. A reply there. A DM that felt too thoughtful to ignore. Hey, saw your thread about media trust metrics. You ever read Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death? That kind of thing. The messages were smart, informed, laced with a kind of subtle flattery that made you feel seen. We talked politics, tech dogs. She sent me memes, articles, even voice notes once or twice. Soft-spoken musings on current events that felt oddly rehearsed, but still authentic enough to disarm me. She wasn't pushing ideology. She was nudging, redirecting, framing. And I wasn't the only one listening. One night, while working late, I noticed a sentiment spike in one of our datasets. Anomalous engagement on immigration topics that didn't align with any major news cycle. It was weird. Organic spikes are messy, chaotic. This one was surgical. Clean. Timed to perfection. I ran a trace. The top performing posts all linked back to the same cluster of accounts. Layla. At History_Malik. At Juno Craves Data. At Ari Reclaims Truth. Different names. Different faces. Same patterns. Same tone. I compiled metadata, ran behavioral overlays, and mapped their engagement frequency. They were all part of a single behavioral architecture. It didn't take long to confirm what I already suspected. These weren't people. They were assets. Every interaction, every meme, every witty one-liner. They were designed, deployed, controlled. I stared at my monitor, heart racing, as the pieces clicked into place. The metadata traced back to a set of servers pinging out of Tallinn, Estonia, encrypted proxy routes bouncing through Stockholm, Bucharest, and finally into a private server block owned by an entity with deep ties to a foreign state. I won't say which one yet. You already know. You feel it in your bones, don't you? I leaned back in my chair, hands shaking. They weren't just watching us. They weren't even pretending anymore. They were steering us. And no one, not the media, not the government, not the goddamn public, had a clue. Except me. I should have reported it right then. Logged it in the client report. Sent the logs to Cyber Command and wiped my hands clean. But I didn't. I wanted to know. I needed to understand how deep it went. Who else was being manipulated? Whether I had fallen under their spell or if I just stumbled into the theater halfway through the show. So I went dark. I built a burner laptop, air-gapped from everything else I owned, used a second-hand black phone, and routed my activity through 5 layers of onion proxies. I spent nights crawling through their networks, their linguistic patterns, their timing algorithms. The accounts were deployed in phases, tied to political seasons and social unrest, like a farmer tracking rainfall. They mimicked real people so perfectly, I began questioning everyone on my own feed, even myself. I stopped sleeping. I'd lie in bed, scrolling endlessly, trying to spot the seams. The artificial cadence of a phrase. A recycled meme template. The uncanny way some accounts seemed to pivot in sync, like birds changing direction mid-flight. By the end of the month, I had a full behavioral map of their campaign. Their focus wasn't to support any party. It was to divide, to inflame, to pit us against each other, until we were too fragmented to see who was pulling the strings. And all of it, every fucking thread, led back to Layla. I opened her last message to me. It was a link to an article about public distrust in democracy. The title, The Erosion of Belief. Her caption read, "Is it even worth saving if no one believes in it anymore?" That was the moment I knew. This wasn't a conversation. It was a campaign. And I'd been a fucking pawn. I slammed the laptop shut, adrenaline pumping through my veins. I felt violated, angry, stupid. I'd spent weeks talking to a ghost, a synthetic persona designed by some foreign engineer trained to mimic human emotion and political nuance. And I fell for it, completely. But this wasn't over. I wasn't going to be just another mark in their system. No, they opened the door, and now I was stepping in. Not as a pawn. Not even as a player, as a threat. They wanted influence? They were about to meet the Echo. Chapter 2, A Network of Ghosts. There's a moment in every horror movie, right after the protagonist opens the wrong door, when they realize the house isn't just creaking, it's breathing. That moment when your gut screams that you should run, but your mind, foolish and curious, convinces you to keep going. That was me, except there were no ghosts in the attic. Just code. And accounts, and voices that weren't real, whispering into a society that no longer knew how to listen without reacting. After I slammed the laptop shut that night, I thought I was done. I told myself I'd report what I found and walk away. Let someone with clearance and a badge take over. But I didn't. Something kept gnawing at me. Some part of my brain couldn't let it go. Because the moment I discovered Layla wasn't real, it broke something inside me. Not because I'd been tricked. Hell, everyone gets fooled online. But because I felt something. I believed I was forming a connection with a person, not an operation. And when that illusion shattered, it didn't just sting, it rewired me. I started seeing ghosts in everything. Every friend, every follower, every DM felt suspect. Who the fuck was I even talking to anymore? The next morning, I didn't go to work. I brewed a pot of coffee, sat on the floor of my apartment with 3 monitors buzzing like warning signs around me, and opened a file I'd labeled silhouettes. It was a list of 312 accounts, including Layla's, that I'd flagged as behavioral anomalies. Their activity was too perfect, timed to trending topics, emotionally optimized to trigger engagement without detection. I began tracking patterns, timestamps, syntax quirks, key phrases repeated with slight variation, things most people would never notice. But I'm not most people. My job had trained me to read beneath the surface, to hear the algorithm between the lines. And what I saw, it scared the shit out of me. These accounts weren't just reactive. They were predictive. They posted about issues that would trend days before they did. They seeded narratives early, let them marinate, then flared them into cultural wildfires when the moment was right. It was like watching an orchestra of invisible hands tuning society like an instrument. But the most disturbing part? They were learning. Their language evolved over time. Their meme styles adapted. Their tone became more empathetic, more vulnerable. One thread even referenced an obscure therapy term, limbic resonance, in the middle of a conversation about voter fatigue. That wasn't coincidence. That was testing. Someone was training these accounts the way you train a conversational AI. Except this wasn't some open beta in a Silicon Valley lab. This was live, on millions of unsuspecting users. Every comment, every reply was part of a psychological operation designed to erode trust, normalize division, and manipulate belief. And we were the guinea pigs. I remember leaning forward, staring at a map I created, an interconnected web of influence between the fake accounts and the real people they engaged with. The lines were thickest around certain nodes, journalists, activists, influencers, even school teachers. These were the people whose voices carried just enough weight to be useful. They weren't bots. They were targets. And I was one of them. Because here's the thing about social media. It doesn't just connect us. It studies us. It records how long we pause on a video, what kind of post makes us rage click, what format keeps our thumb from swiping up. It's a mirror that reflects our weaknesses, and then sells those weaknesses to the highest bidder. That mirror had been weaponized. And the reflection staring back at me? It was cracked, fractured, manipulated beyond recognition. I dug deeper. I started creating decoy accounts, new profiles with randomized demographics, varied political alignments, unique behavioral flags. I watched how the fake network interacted with each one. With my left-leaning decoy, they nudged anti-establishment rhetoric. With the centrist, they sowed confusion. With the far-right persona, rage. Always rage. It wasn't about pushing a belief. It was about polarization. Making sure everyone believed someone else was the enemy. It didn't matter what side you were on, as long as you were pointing fingers and screaming. Divide. Distract. Dilute. That was the real strategy. The scariest part was how good they were at it. One of my decoys, a teacher from Ohio named Hannah Mills, got a message from a parent account asking about school closures. It led to a conversation about CRT, then education funding, then voter fraud. Within 4 days, Hannah was in a Telegram group filled with conspiracy theorists posting about armed protests at state capitals. 4 fucking days. And the scariest part? Half the people in the chat were real. You could tell. Their messages were too messy, too emotional. But the handlers, whoever was behind the operation, they let it run. They didn't have to post much. They just had to plant the spark. The fire spread on its own. I stopped answering calls. Ignored emails. My world shrunk to that room, that chair, those monitors. My friends thought I was ghosting them. My boss sent a passive-aggressive Slack message that I never replied to. I didn't care. I was in the belly of the beast. And then I found something new. It was buried in the code of a seemingly harmless account at Daily Policy Digest. Just another reposting bot, or so I thought. But its source code pinged a server not in Estonia this time, but in New Jersey, a private firm with a benign name, Meridian Dynamics. I traced the registration, cross-referenced funding disclosures, followed the paper trail. It was a shell company, owned by another shell company, owned by a trust fund registered in a country with no extradition laws. It was all connected. And Layla? She was one of the originals. I discovered archived code fragments, early builds of her personality file, written in a language I hadn't seen before. Not quite Python. Not quite human. It was modular, adaptive, terrifyingly advanced. That's when I realized this wasn't a rogue operation. This was a program. A system. Built with military-level precision, psychological insight, and long-term vision. And I'd been marked. Not just as a target, but as a threat. The next morning, my burner phone buzzed. No number. No name. Just a message. Stop digging. Or next time, it won't be your inbox we breach. My blood ran cold. I stared at the screen, heart pounding, brain spiraling into possibilities. How did they get this number? How deep were they watching me? Were they in my apartment? Had they tapped my internet? My phone? I scanned the room, paranoid. I ripped apart my router, tossed the SIM, smashed the burner against the wall. But I knew it didn't matter. They were already in. Not just in my systems, but in me, in my head, whispering doubt, feeding fear, turning my life into another battleground in a war most people didn't even know existed. But I wasn't going to run, not yet, because the deeper I dug, the more I understood what was really at stake. This wasn't about bots or politics or Twitter trends. This was about truth, and I was going to find it, even if it cost me everything. Chapter 3. The tipping point. Paranoia doesn't come in like a thunderclap. It seeps. It creeps. One day you're scanning IP logs in a dim apartment. The next you're hesitating before turning on your lights, wondering if there's a camera tucked behind your ceiling fan. It's not fear that gets you, not at first. It's the doubt. That splintered voice that worms into your every thought, whispering, "What if they're already watching?" After the message, stop digging. Or next time, it won't be your inbox we breach. I didn't sleep for 3 days. I installed a VPN. Then, another. Then, a self-randomizing proxy rotation system I barely understood myself. I unplugged every smart device. Covered every lens. I even stopped using the microwave. Paranoia? No. This was survival. Because here's the truth no one wants to say out loud. If they want to find you, they will. They didn't need to threaten me to get me to stop. But they made a mistake. They made it personal. I started to catalog every interaction I'd ever had with the shadow accounts. Every thread Layla commented on. Every post Ari shared. Every meme Malik reposted. I didn't just analyze their behavior. I reconstructed it. I reverse-engineered entire social dialogues to see what narratives they were constructing. It wasn't random. It was surgical. Topics rotated on a cycle. Immigration on Mondays, voting integrity on Wednesdays, gun control on weekends. Every 10-day window, they shifted tones. Optimism, outrage, irony, despair. They knew exactly when to amplify, when to retreat. It was like watching a psychological ballet, graceful, sinister, methodical. But then I noticed something else. Buried between the rage bait and the culture war memes, there was another pattern, a subtler signal. A string of nearly identical phrases whispered across dozens of accounts. We all feel it coming, or they'll wake up when it's too late, or the echo always returns. The echo. That phrase stopped me cold. It had shown up 39 times in a 6-month dataset, each time from a different account. Each time, in the common thread of a real person whose post had started to gain traction. They weren't just nudging public opinion. They were targeting influence vectors. People whose words were gaining organic reach. People like journalists, podcasters, whistleblowers, even meme pages with high share ratios. And after the echo phrase was posted, engagement plummeted. Shadow bans followed. Comments filled with trolls and bots. The original poster's credibility shredded. It was a kill switch, a digital whisper that marked someone for neutralization. I needed proof. I couldn't just rely on data. Not anymore. So I did something reckless. I reached out to someone I shouldn't have, Elena Chavez, an independent journalist who had gone dark after being accused of peddling misinformation about defense contracts and social media influence operations. She used to write for Beacon Intel, until her editor denounced her, her sources disappeared, and her apartment was mysteriously robbed with nothing stolen but her hard drives. I'd read every word she ever published, and I knew in my gut she hadn't been wrong. She'd been silenced. It took me 4 days, a burner SIM card, and a late-night DM through an encrypted forum just to get her to answer. When she finally responded, all she sent was a signal. If you're not wearing a wire, meet me in person. No electronics, just proof. We met in a parking garage on the east side of town. Classic spy shit. She wore a hoodie, no makeup, and a look that told me she hadn't slept in weeks. Her eyes scanned every car, every shadow. I didn't blame her. She barely said a word at first. Just held out a manila envelope. Inside, printouts, redacted reports, a flash drive, and a single photo that made my knees go weak. It was Layla's face. Uncropped, unfiltered, except it wasn't a selfie. It was a surveillance photo, time-stamped, GPS-tagged. Not a real woman reading on a fire escape, but a facial model used in multiple AI-generated personas traced back to an Eastern European disinformation farm. Her face was a composite, part social engineering, part stolen reality. Elena finally spoke. Her name's not Layla. Her face is a blend of six real women. We traced three of them. Two are dead. One's missing. I couldn't breathe. I felt like I was falling through the floor. How long? I asked. Elena lit a cigarette. They've been operational since 2015, but it escalated in 2020 when they linked up with domestic ops. Now, it's not just one country running psyops. It's five, and they're trading playbooks like poker chips. She handed me the flash drive. It's all in there. Internal emails, budget trails, a list of influence nodes. You've probably been one since the moment you replied to her. I nodded, unable to speak. They don't need to hack elections, she said flatly. They just need you to not trust them. That's enough. That's all it takes. And then she was gone. I went home, locked the door, downloaded the files. It took 3 hours to decrypt everything. What I saw changed me. The documents detailed how foreign governments had identified vulnerable democratic institutions and embedded manipulation strategies across four pillars. Media fatigue. Flood timelines with controversy until truth becomes subjective. False consensus. Amplify fringe views until they feel mainstream. Emotional flooding. Drown users in rage, fear, or helplessness until they disengage. Strategic erasure. Identify rising dissenters and deploy echo accounts to silence them. Each pillar came with data, results, success metrics. They had numbers, timelines, fucking goals. It was a game to them. A war fought with code instead of bullets. A war where the front line was your feed and the casualty was your sanity. That night, I didn't cry. I didn't rage. I just stared at my own reflection in the laptop screen. Eyes bloodshot, face pale, and realized something horrifying. I was no longer an analyst. I was now a liability, because I knew the system. And worse, I understood how to break it. The next morning, my laptop wouldn't boot. My backup drives were corrupted. My Wi-Fi router wouldn't reset. I checked my apartment door. The lock was scratched. My hands trembled. I wasn't being watched. I was being warned. Everything in my body screamed at me to stop, to burn it all, to disappear, to forget Layla, to walk away from the whispers. But I couldn't, because I kept seeing those words in my head. The echo always returns. It wasn't just a phrase. It was a prophecy. And I was going to make sure it came back to them. Chapter 4, Trigger Warnings. There's a sound your mind makes when it breaks. It's not a scream or a sob or even a whisper. It's silence. Heavy. Suffocating. Like standing at the bottom of a drained pool and realizing you're still drowning. That's where I was, alone, apartment dark, flash drive empty, computer lifeless, and reality unraveling by the hour. The more I pulled at the strings of truth, the more they wrapped around my throat. I didn't know it yet, but I'd already crossed the event horizon. There was no going back. No normal to return to. They made sure of that. I tried contacting Elena again. No answer. Her burner account was gone. Wiped. No trace in the forum where we met. No metadata. No cached threads. It was like she'd never existed. Like I'd hallucinated her into being. But I hadn't. I still had her cigarette, but in a paper towel on my desk, like some deranged relic. That was my proof. That, and the flash drive I'd copied twice over, before decrypting it. You learn things fast when you're hunted. You learn that evidence doesn't mean anything if you're dead. I checked into a cheap motel off I-95 under a fake name, Colin Grant. Paid cash. Brought only my backup laptop, the drive, a Faraday bag, and a portable generator. No phones. No Wi-Fi. Just me and the walls that felt thinner than tissue paper. The first night, I didn't sleep. I sat in a folding chair and watched the room like a soldier waiting for a sniper. Every creak made my heart jerk. Every headlight outside made me flinch. And yet part of me felt alive for the first time in years. I was no longer a bystander. I was the virus inside their machine. The drive Elena gave me was dense. Layers of encryption stacked like Russian dolls, custom-built file obfuscation methods. I had to write custom scripts just to crack. Whoever designed it knew exactly what they were doing. The folders had no names, just numbers. Inside case files, names, faces, real people. One by one, I opened them, saw the logs, the influence reports, the timeline of psychological breakdowns and online harassment campaigns. One man, a sociology professor in Oregon, had written a blog post about bipartisan media funding. Within 2 weeks, he'd been labeled a closet extremist, had his home address leaked, and eventually lost tenure. There were hundreds like him. Some were activists, others just random citizens, people with just enough reach to matter. People like me, people like you. And the worst part? Some of them didn't even know they'd been targeted. They thought the world had turned on them. They thought they were losing their minds. But it wasn't the world. It wasn't mental illness. It was them. Somewhere around hour 19 of decoding and cataloging, I found a video file buried deep in a nested folder called Pandora_B2. It had no metadata, no file name, just a 27-minute video, grainy, shaky footage taken from a hidden camera inside a boardroom. The faces were blurred. The voices weren't. We don't need to convince them what to believe. Just make them question everything they've ever believed before. Laughter. A woman's voice, accented, maybe Eastern European, added, "Truth is a luxury. Confusion is cheaper and far more effective." Another voice chimed in, "We've got a 32% increase in polarization since last quarter. That's billions in instability value. Keep the cycle running." Instability. Value. Like suffering was just another market. The rest of the meeting was worse. Charts of suicide rates, protest escalations, voter withdrawal. These weren't bugs in their system. They were metrics, objectives, and they were winning. After watching that video 5 times, I threw up in the motel sink. Then I opened my laptop again and started building my own system. Because if they could use networks to manipulate people, so could I. But not for chaos, for clarity, for exposure. It started with a new Twitter profile at Echo Reversed. No face. No name. Just truth. I created a botnet using recycled code from the drive, stripped of manipulation triggers, retarget for signal boosting instead of suppression. I didn't need to lie. I just needed to show people the cracks. I posted a thread at 3:14 a.m. Ever feel like the arguments you're seeing online aren't really yours? That the rage you feel isn't entirely your own? It's not a coincidence. You're being trained, not informed, trained. Let me show you how. I linked the patterns, the cycles, the language overlaps. I didn't say who was responsible, not yet, but I knew people would listen. The first hour, 27 likes. By dawn, 3,400 retweets. By noon, hashtag Echo Reversed was trending in 4 states. That night, my motel room door rattled at 2:03 a.m. Just once. Then silence. I didn't sleep. I packed and left before sunrise. drove until the gas light blinked and still kept going. I was being hunted, but I wasn't hiding anymore. I was broadcasting. That week, I posted daily. Each thread peeled back a new layer. How they targeted emotion. How they hijacked language. How they mapped engagement vectors. How memes evolved across ideological lines with barely noticeable changes that triggered different neural pathways. I included screenshots, network graphs, behavioral timelines. I made it undeniable, and people started to wake up, some with rage, some with awe, some with pure, white-hot fear. But not all reactions were organic. By day three, I noticed something, the counter-effort. New accounts were popping up by the hour to debunk me, saying I was a Russian psyop or CIA disinfo or a schizophrenic basement blogger. The comments beneath my posts were 50-50 venom and support. Perfect division. Exactly what they wanted. Then I got an email. Anonymous sender. No subject. Just a link. I clicked. It was a live stream. A woman was sitting in a dark room. Hood over her head. Duct tape over her mouth. And I knew that face. Elena. My chest turned to ice. The camera zoomed slightly. A caption appeared on screen. Stop, or this becomes permanent. Then the stream cut out. No audio. No trace. No fucking clue where she was. I wanted to scream. Instead, I smashed my fist into the motel mirror. Blood poured down my knuckles. I pressed it to the screen. No, I whispered. I'm just getting started. They wanted me scared. They wanted me silent. But fear and fury are twin engines. And I had just filled the tank. That night, I wrote my most dangerous thread yet. They took someone. Her name is Elena Chavez. You know her as a discredited journalist. She's not. She's real. And she's proof. This isn't just digital anymore. This is physical. Human. And they've crossed the line. I'm not posting to go viral. I'm posting to survive. If anything happens to me, I've scheduled dead man triggers with encrypted vaults. They drop everything. Names, companies, timestamps. It will all burn. Truth has weight. Let's drop it like a bomb. It went nuclear. Millions of views in hours. News outlets started sniffing around. Reddit exploded. A subreddit, r/echofiles, appeared overnight. Some called me a hero. Others called me a false flag. I didn't care. Because now the world was watching. And the mirror they shattered? I was turning it back toward them. Chapter 5. The Anatomy of Collapse. What does it feel like to be hunted by an idea? Not a person. Not a government. An idea. Something formless, shifting, born of code and chaos. Something that doesn't bleed or sleep or negotiate. You can't stab it. You can't beg it. You can't even look it in the eye. Because it is the eye. And it's always open. That's what it became. This thing I was fighting. It wasn't just a network anymore. Not just faceless operators behind screens sipping espresso in fortified basements. No, it had evolved into something worse. It had become normal. And that's how you lose a war without firing a shot. After the Elena livestream, I went underground, deeper than before, burned through the last of my decoy devices. Used a darknet router scavenged from a defunct crypto mining operation in South Carolina. I coded a rotating dead man switch system, automated time release drops that would detonate every piece of intel I'd gathered if I missed a check-in. I couldn't afford another mistake. I couldn't afford to lose her. But most of all, I couldn't afford to doubt what I knew. Because I was starting to feel it again, that creeping hum of unreality. Like the world around me was being edited in real time. People I trusted stopped replying. Headlines disappeared mid-scroll. Entire Reddit threads wiped clean. It was like watching sand slip through a sieve I couldn't plug. And it wasn't just me. A journalist named Marco Daniels reached out via encrypted email. He'd seen my threads. Had sources. Said he could help. I hesitated for 2 days. Checked his credentials. Tracked his bylines. He was legit. Former war correspondent. 3 Pulitzer nominations. Fired from a ledger after refusing to soften a piece on media manipulation in Central America. I agreed to meet. The cafe was loud, bodies pressed together in forced normalcy. The kind of place that smelled like burnt espresso and betrayal. Marco sat in the corner, sunglasses indoors, worn leather notebook open beside a cracked laptop. He didn't waste time. "You've kicked the hornet's nest," he said. I nodded. "They're not just foreign anymore," he continued. "They franchised. Local actors, domestic firms, lobbyists, PACs, even NGOs. Some of them know what they're part of. Most don't." I leaned forward. "You're saying it's bigger than state-sponsored PSYOPs?" Marco's jaw tightened. "I'm saying the state is the PSYOP." He slid a folded piece of paper across the table. On it, a list of 6 companies. All American. All seemingly unaffiliated. But I recognized 3 of the names. They were listed in the drive Elena gave me. "Those firms," Marco said, "all received funding through a shadow grant routed via the National Strategic Innovation Lab. Sounds innocent, right?" He tapped the table. "That lab is run by someone named Victor Lang." My stomach dropped. Victor Lang was my old boss, the man who brought me into behavioral analytics straight out of grad school, the man who told me we were protecting democracy by understanding online mood dynamics, the man who once told me, over scotch and cynicism, "Public opinion is just a wave. We teach them which way to break." The betrayal tasted like metal in my mouth. He wasn't just connected. He was the architect. That night, I dug into every file I had on Lang. Employment records. Corporate ties. Voting history. Travel logs. Everything. And, behind the polished career, the think tank papers. The panel interviews on C-SPAN. A second life. Multiple shell corps tied to server farms in Malaysia, Estonia, Venezuela. Black budget contracts signed under dummy firms. One of them? Meridian Dynamics. I remembered that name from Chapter 2. The fake firm that pinged back from New Jersey. Lang didn't work for the machine. He built it. And I was his beta test. The realization shattered me. I wasn't just a pawn. I was groomed. He'd hired me because I was idealistic, sharp, and hungry to make sense of chaos. He taught me the language, gave me access, showed me the tools, and all the while, he was planting seeds in my head, training me to trust the system even as it hollowed out truth. And when I got too close, they sent Layla. My gut twisted with rage, betrayal, self-disgust. He used me like he used everyone else. Because in Lang's world, loyalty was just another dataset. I posted the first thread about him the next morning. Didn't name him, not yet. Just alluded to a founding architect behind Meridian Dynamics. Posed rhetorical questions. Shared breadcrumbs. Let the internet chew on it. It went viral. Within 12 hours, someone hacked into my dormant LinkedIn and posted a resignation letter that I never wrote. One that made me sound deranged. The caption read, "Another tech bro loses his mind chasing ghosts." The replies were brutal. I was called everything, spy, liar, incel, terrorist, lunatic. People who'd supported me 2 days ago were now accusing me of staging it all for clout. That's the terrifying part about digital warfare. You don't have to kill a man to erase him. You just have to make him unbelievable. But not everyone was fooled. A darknet collective called NullSig reached out. They were rogue ethical hackers, former cybersecurity agents turned ghost ops. They said they'd been watching my threads, and more importantly, they'd been watching Lang. They had access to a server cluster he forgot to wipe in a rush job. Inside, call recordings, email strings, behavior model experiments. One document stopped me cold. Subject: Echo Initiative, Controlled Civil Instability Pilot. United States, Phase 3. Goal: reduce voter confidence by 37% in swing states. Timeline: 18 months. Mechanisms: online discourse manipulation, AI-generated influencers, emotional fatigue campaigns. I felt sick. This wasn't some passive system feeding on chaos. It was designed to fracture us. With NullSig's help, I built a broadcast tool, an automated data leak scheduler called MirrorCrack. it released timed packets of truth across every major social channel. Discord, Telegram, X, Mastodon, Reddit, even gaming servers. We flooded the digital bloodstream. I didn't care if I got doxxed, canceled, swatted. This wasn't about me anymore. It was about giving people a fucking chance to see what was happening before it swallowed everything. And then, 3 nights later, I got a call. Unknown number. I almost didn't answer. But something made me. Hello. I said, voice low. Static. Then a faint cough. Then, Casey. It was her. It was Elena. Alive. Bruised. Scared. Whispering. I don't have long. I'm in Prague. They moved me. I escaped during transport. I have everything. The root server location, the control protocols, all of it. My heart stopped. I'm sending you coordinates, she whispered. Don't trust the embassy. Don't trust anyone. Static again. Then silence. I stared at the phone, shaking. This was it. The kill switch. The heart of the operation. The source. It was real. But I knew what that meant. If I went after it, there was no coming back. No shadows left to hide in. No burner sims. No bunker deep enough. This would be the final act. The moment the echo would either return or be silenced forever. I shut my laptop, lit a cigarette I didn't even smoke, and whispered, time to end this. Chapter 6. The center does not hold. Truth doesn't burn you like fire. It unravels you thread by thread, fiber by fiber, until you're staring at the bones of something that never had a soul to begin with. That's where I was. Unraveled. Frayed. But not broken. Not yet. I had Elena's coordinates. I had names, files, a growing swarm of underground allies, and a boiling conviction that there was only one way this ended. With light. Blinding, irreversible, unbearable light on the thing that had festered in the dark for far too long. But first, I had to make it to Prague alive. Traveling under a false identity was one thing when you were hiding from exes or creditors. It was another when you were evading transnational psychological warfare networks with AI surveillance tools that knew your typing cadence better than your own mother. Still, I pulled it off. Bought tickets under an ID I'd forged through a defunct Belarusian passport broker who owed Null Sig a favor. Took 3 different flights, each connecting through chaos. Sao Paulo, Casablanca, Oslo. Dumped my burner at every stop. Slept with one eye open, if I slept at all. By the time I landed in Prague, I hadn't eaten in 30 hours. My heart was a jackhammer. My nerves were glass. My mind, still sharp, but slipping. Every face looked like a threat. Every echo in the train station made me flinch. But Elena was alive. That was all that mattered. She met me just after midnight on the Charles Bridge. Classic. The wind off the river was sharp enough to cut bone. The kind of cold that reminded you of mortality. She wore a coat too thin for the season, a black knit cap, and gloves that trembled when she handed me a USB. Encrypted 3 layers deep, she said, voice raw from exhaustion or screaming. I wasn't sure which. It's everything. The core architecture. The psychological compliance flow. Root server access nodes. All of it. My breath caught. How'd you get this? She gave a half smile that didn't reach her eyes. I told them I'd cracked. They let me near a terminal. I stared at her. Elena. They underestimated me, she said, voice breaking for just a moment. They always fucking underestimate women who don't scream. Then she looked past me, eyes narrowing. They're here. I turned. 2 figures. Long coats. Shadows swallowing their faces. Moving with intent. The kind of intent that didn't walk away if you said, sorry, wrong person. We ran. The alleys of Prague at night feel like a bad dream. Narrow, endless. Cobblestones slick with history and something darker. Elena led, weaving through courtyards and tunnels like she'd lived 100 lives here. I followed, heart slamming against my ribs, the USB tight in my fist. We ducked into a church. Not for sanctuary, but for confusion. Spiral staircases. Stone crypts. Ancient wooden pews that whispered prayers of lost wars. They won't touch us here, she said, breathless. Why? optics. Too public. Too holy. Too loud. She collapsed into a pew, and I knelt beside her. She looked at me, like she had seconds left to live. "I saw the control room," she whispered. "Rows of people. No emotion. Just screens. They called it the Chamber of Relevance." I blinked. "What?" "It's where they decide what's real. In real time." I stared at her, stunned. "You're saying reality is voted on?" She nodded slowly. "Algorithms propose. Analysts refine. Executives approve. Within seconds, the narrative is seeded. If you fight it, you're marked." The echo. "Exactly." She leaned forward, eyes glassy. "They're not just making fake people anymore, Casey. They're building networks of influence from scratch. Fake podcasters. Fake citizen journalists. Even entire communities, comment histories, follower lists, conversations. All AI-generated. But so consistent, so human, no one questions them. Holy shit. They're calling them synthetic publics. And they've been testing them on regional discourse in swing states. No one knows. They think they're arguing with neighbors. But they're shouting into a maze." I sat back, stunned. "You know what the worst part is?" she asked. I didn't answer. She leaned in, barely audible. "They've started experimenting with emotion implants." "What?" "I mean injecting targeted emotional responses into real users through interaction feedback loops. Dopamine spikes. Anxiety triggers. Rage reinforcement. Using your own digital behavior to train you into belief systems without your consent." It felt like my spine turned to ice. "They're not changing what we think," I said quietly. "They're changing how we think," she finished. We knew we couldn't stay. We switched locations every 3 hours. A hostel. A library. A sauna. An internet cafe run by a punk anarchist collective who let us plug into a rat's nest of custom hardware for exactly one espresso and a promise to burn it all. We decrypted the USB in layers. Each layer peeled back a new horror. There were files labeled Target Calibration, Gen Z, detailing meme injection patterns and satire redirection techniques. Another folder titled Phase 4, Crisis Seeding, contained scheduled provocations, controversial incidents staged across fake local news networks, waiting to be released at opportune political moments. But the worst? A file labeled Failsafes. Inside, a list of individuals marked for neutralization in the event of exposure. I was number 14. Elena was number 9. Lang's signature was on the approval request. We went silent for 2 days. No contact with the outside world. No posts. No leaks. Just planning. Because now we had everything. We weren't just exposing influence anymore. We were going to burn the core. We mapped out the root servers, 7 global nodes, but one master control relay hidden beneath a private data haven off the coast of Greenland. It was operated by a shell company registered to a now-deceased Estonian diplomat who once sat on the board of Meridian Dynamics. Classic. But the access key wasn't digital. It was human. Lang. His biometric signature was tied to the kill protocols. If we wanted to shut it down permanently, we needed his presence. His body. His heartbeat. Elena turned to me in the flickering glow of a busted hostel lamp. We have two choices. We either leak the documents and let the public devour itself in confusion, or we take him down. In person. I nodded slowly. You know which one I'll pick. The final message from Null Sig came encrypted through an analog audio channel. A robotic voice gave the coordinates. Lang would be attending a private symposium in Berlin under an alias. High level. Closed doors. No media. A perfect place to disappear someone if things went sideways. Perfect place to end a war. I turned to Elena. She didn't say anything. She didn't have to. We packed our gear, checked our backups, and stepped into the final act. The storm wasn't coming. We were the storm. Chapter 7. The echo always returns. They say every revolution begins with a whisper. But that's a lie. Revolutions begin with doubt, a fracture in the story, a glitch in the matrix, a second of silence in the middle of the noise. And if you're lucky or cursed, you hear it. That first ripple. That quiet tremor in your gut that tells you something is deeply, cosmically wrong. For me, that doubt became obsession. That obsession became war. And now, war had brought me here, standing at the gates of a Berlin high-rise that looked like the future had vomited up glass and steel and called it progress. Inside, Victor Lang was giving a keynote address to the world's elite, tech CEOs, black budget consultants, military futurists, and the occasional hedge fund sociopath who mistook control for genius. Outside, Elena and I were ghosts, scarred, hunted, armed with nothing but encrypted drives, forged press badges, and the kind of conviction that only comes after you've seen the devil and chosen to charge him anyway. The plan wasn't perfect, but it was simple. Get in. Trigger Lang's biometric confirmation. Gain access to the Greenland root server. Run the override script. Delete the entire Echo initiative from existence. Accounts, bots, protocols, data, and command structures. One shot. One chance. Because once we pull the trigger, we'd be marked. Globally. Irreversibly. And we were ready. The building's lobby was an ocean of arrogance. Floor-to-ceiling security, retina scans, drone escorts, chrome-plated everything. But all it took was one nod, one handshake, one subtle misdirection. Elena smiling at the right guard, me walking like I belonged. And we were in. The symposium was already underway. I could hear Lang's voice over the PA system. Smooth, confident, sickening. Our responsibility as architects of tomorrow is not to wait for the public to understand complexity, but to guide them through it. Gently, invisibly, permanently. The room applauded. The kind of applause that hides rot behind Rolexes. I wanted to tear the whole place down, but I had to stay focused. We slipped into the control annex on the third floor, a high-security enclave where VIPs demoed the Echo platform. It was a temple of digital influence. Touchscreens wrapped the walls, showing live manipulation dashboards. Trending topics nudged in real time, heat maps of emotional resonance by region, and clusters of synthetic public networks adjusting their tone based on shifting cultural mood swings. It was mind control at scale, and Lang was its god. Elena opened the briefcase. Inside, a portable node synced to the Kill protocol, armed with NullSig's override software. All we needed was a pulse scan, and Lang's hand. Literally. I stared at her. You're sure about this? She looked up, eyes hard. I didn't survive what they did to me just to expose them. I survived to end them. We stepped into the main auditorium. Lang was wrapping up his speech, hands clasped like a priest about to bless his flock. He hadn't seen us yet. His silver hair caught the light like a halo. His suit flawless. His voice molten certainty. But beneath that exterior was the monster who'd erased people like spreadsheets, who'd played with lives like toggles in a UX experiment, who'd turned society into an API call. I waited until he walked off stage. And then I followed. Backstage security was tight, but this wasn't my first infiltration. A short hallway. Two guards. A service closet. A neural zapper rigged into a fake badge scanner. 3 seconds later, they were unconscious. Lang was standing by a vanity mirror, adjusting his cufflinks. I stepped in. He turned. And for the first time, I saw him without a camera filter. Older, thinner, hungrier, but still arrogant. Casey, he said, as if greeting an old friend. I was wondering when you'd crawl out of your hiding hole. I said nothing. Elena entered behind me, the briefcase in her hands. His smile didn't falter. You really think you can stop it? This isn't just a network. It's evolution. No, I said coldly. It's rot in a glass cathedral. He chuckled. The public wants this. They want certainty. Structure. We give them the illusion of chaos so they don't panic. We protect them from themselves. You don't protect people, Elena spat. You puppeteer them. Lang raised a brow. Better that than anarchy. I moved closer. Place your hand on the scanner, I said. He looked amused. And if I don't? I drew the pistol. His amusement vanished. I taught you better than this, he whispered. No, I said. You taught me how to serve a system, but I learned how to dismantle it. He looked at me for a long moment, and then he placed his hand on the scanner. The briefcase beeped. A green light blinked. Access granted. And just like that, the floodgates opened. The script launched. Across the world, the Echo network began to die. Thousands of synthetic accounts blinked into nothing. Botnets collapsed. Influence campaigns dissolved. Comment threads fell silent. And then, the root server in Greenland began to self-wipe. Line by line, file by file, the truth wasn't just being revealed. It was being freed. Lang tried to move. Elena stepped forward and tossed him without hesitation. He collapsed, twitching. I uploaded one final message, distributed across every channel. We were never supposed to see behind the curtain. But we did. This is not conspiracy. This is confession. The truth is yours now. Do not let it slip through your fingers again. And then, I destroyed the briefcase. Smashed it with a fire extinguisher. Lit it on fire. Watched it melt down to slag. There would be no second echo. Not on our watch. We disappeared after that. Vanished into digital silence. Some say we died. Others say we were arrested. One theory claims we're living in an Icelandic commune, growing mushrooms and rewriting neural ethics protocols. The truth? We're still watching. Because even though we shut down the machine, the idea lives on. Not because of power, but because of apathy. Because the easiest lie to believe is the one you want to be true. So, if you're hearing this, if my voice is still echoing in your ears, then listen closely. You are not immune. Every post, every like, every argument that feels too perfect. Ask yourself, is it yours or is it the echo? Because in this war, truth isn't lost. It's buried. And someone like you, has to dig it up again. The echo always returns. But now so do we.